Our understanding is there's a class in here at 3. So I'd like to welcome you to the PIMS Distinguished Chair Lecture Series. And if, for those of you who don't know, I'm Gary Margrave, and I'm the new PIMS Site Director. This is the first of 6 lectures by the PIMS Distinguished Chair for Calgary, Dr. Vladimir Tureyev. And I'll just say a couple of words about Vladimir's background. Vladimir graduated from Leningrad University in 1975. Got his PhD at Steklov Mathematical Institute, Moscow, in 79, and he stayed at Steklov till 1990. Yeah, till 1990 as a researcher, and he is presently director of research with the National Center of Scientific Research in Strasbourg. And as I understand it, Vladimir's research interests are primarily low-dimensional topology and topological quantum mechanics, quantum theory. So, Vladimir, I'll just turn it over to you. And one last thing to mention is that we'll finish pretty much promptly at 3, and there's coffee and donuts free in the library.
So first of all, I would like to thank PIMS for giving me this opportunity to give these lectures, and also for the coffee in advance. Now, as you said, that's going to be a series of 6 lectures concerned with, is a part of three-dimensional topology, that is topology of three-dimensional manifolds. This part is devoted to certain invariants of three-dimensional manifolds, which are called torsions. Now, today, I'm going to give a very elementary lecture, introductory lecture. Also, we'll see this this record. There are high school students in the audience, so I'm going to be more or less. I would like to be understandable at least during the few first minutes to the high school students. All right. Now, topology is a part of mathematics which studies spaces. So, spaces. It's not so easy to define what a space is because there are very different viewpoints. So, instead of defining what a space is, I'm going to give a couple of examples. So, one simple example is a line. So, line. This is a line, Euclidean line, which you may identify with a set of real numbers.
This is what we're videotaping you're talking about. Yes. If you can write a bit bigger, it'll come up.
Yeah. Okay. Line. So,
thank you.
Okay.
That's good.
All right. So, this is just a line of real numbers. You may have 0, 1, 2, 3, here you get P, so on. Well, you should know that mathematicians always use names. And names, in our case, are just symbols. So the line is always denoted by this symbol. I hope it is big enough. It is R. Now, some more spaces say circle. Circle. So this is circle. I hope you believe me, it's circle. Well, it is usually denoted as 1. But this is in half cases, I'm going to say circle. In half cases, I'm going to say S1. So this is just the same thing. All right. Let me give you a few more examples of a disk. So disk is what is inside the circle and the circle itself. So this is a two-dimensional disk. Well, usually it is denoted D2. All right, some more examples. Sphere. Sphere, I'm going to draw. So sphere is the surface of the ball. So we take a ball. That's a sphere, and the sign, the symbol which one usually uses is S2. Now, I would like to draw a 3 ball. So the 3 ball is the same thing, but you include all the points inside. So everything is up. So this is denoted this. Now you may ask already, what are these finite numbers here? 1, 2, 2, 3, and so on. So these finite numbers are dimensions. So what is dimension of a space? Dimension is a number of degrees of freedom. So if you put yourself here at the point and you want to move into space, you have only 1 degree of freedom. That's why here you have 1. Whereas if you put yourself here in the disk, you have 2 degrees of freedom. That's why it is 2-dimensional. So the dimension is a number of degrees of freedom. All right. So this step. Now the next question is, what we are interested in. So we have the spaces, what we want to know. So our general question, sort of the question which underlies the whole topology is, when two spaces have the same form. All right. Now, what does it mean to have the same form? This very interesting question arises in real life. For instance, in criminalistic. Assume that you come back to home, and on your desk you find a fingerprint, which looks like this. All right. So you call the police officer. Police officer comes. It tells you, all right, we have a big library of fingerprints, and in our library, we have a thing like that. Okay, you say, that's probably the same guy. Because they have the same form. The fingerprints have the same form. So how we see? You sort of course, they are slightly different, right? This one is a little bigger, for instance. But the form, the shape, is the same. And how you establish it, sort of you compare it point by point. There is one special point here, one special point here. So you may assign this point with this point, this looks the same, this thing looks the same, and so on. So these guys have the same form. But if in the police library you have something like that, or you say that's probably wrong. It's not the criminal we want, because that's a different form, right? Okay, so it is interesting that this idea of fingerprints actually appeared in criminalistic at the same time when topology evolved in mathematics. So this idea of having the same form probably wasn't there. It was at the beginning of the 20th century. So how did topologists say formally? Assume that you have two spaces, X and Y. So these are two spaces. Topologists define the notion of a homeomorphism. Homeomorphism between such spaces. So a homeomorphism is a rule. So it's a rule. It's a rule which puts the points of X and Y, in one-to-one correspondence. Well, it means that to each point of this space, so if X, small x, is a point of this space, you should assign to it a point of this space, and vice versa. So it should be one-to-one correspondence between points of these two spaces. And the correspondence should be continuous. It means you have no right to break spaces in one-to-one correspondence, which should be continuous. Well, it should be continuous. In both spaces, that's going from small x to small y, or from small y to small x, it should be continuous. Continuous means points which are close to each other should go to points which are close to each other. Continuous in both ways, in both directions. All right. Now, where does this word come from? That's a very interesting word, which shows how much our civilization owes to Greeks, ancient Greeks. So let me explain to you what does it mean in Greek. So the word morph, this means, in ancient Greek, it means a form. Form. So for you, I write it in Greek. So mu, pro, rho, phi, eta. It's very easy to read in ancient Greek. You just read, pronounce only the... you have to know Greek letters, and then you pronounce only just only the first letter. This is M, morphe. So morphe means the form in Greek. Now, homo, this is means similar, and in Greek it was homois. So the word means, this word means these spaces have similar form. All right. Now let me give you examples of spaces which are, spaces, if there is such a homeomorphism, so if there is such a one-to-one rule as here, then these spaces X and Y are self-homeomorphic. So they are homeomorphic if there is such a homeomorphism between X and Y. Now, the main problem of topology, as I wrote, is suppose you are given two spaces, can you say whether they are homeomorphic or not? Do they have the same shape? And topologists, during the last century, provided lots of tools to solve this question, in the negative or in the positive. So I'm going to give you two examples. So one example, let's say a half circle and an interval. So I do not include the endpoint. What do you mean? So these two spaces, so that's X, this is Y, they are homeomorphic. How we establish such a rule? This is just projection. You take any point of X and you project it to the interval. You see immediately that that's a bijective correspondence, that's one-to-one correspondence. It is continuous in both directions, let's say, are homeomorphic. Or let me produce another example. Let's say a guy like this, a space like this, and again an interval. Well, they are also homeomorphic. For instance, you can see it the following way. Let me draw these two lines. So my space X is going to be blue. So this is X. And my space Y is going to be red. So this is Y. Now how you establish a homeomorphism? You position yourself in this point and you blow X. So you blow at X so that all points are from X. Each point of X goes to the point of Y. So you blow, and this point, small x, goes here, right. So this establishes a bijective correspondence, one-to-one correspondence between X and Y, between points of X and points of Y. So they are homeomorphic. So in this case, X and Y are homeomorphic. All right, let me give an example of two non-homeomorphic spaces. For instance, S1 and S2. are they homomorphic? The answer is no, because they have different dimensions. So the dimension, if two spaces are homomorphic, they should have the same dimension. Because, well, if you can move points here in two different directions, then the images and the homomorphism also would move on in two different directions. So these two spaces are not homomorphic. All right. Now an interesting question is a circle homomorphic to a line. Here you cannot use dimension because both of them have one dimension or dimension one. But the answer is still no. They are not homomorphic. So how you see it? Well, this is a circle. This is a line. It's not so easy to prove. Well, the basic fact is that here on the line you can have a sequence of points like that, which sort of goes to infinity. For instance, 0, 1, 2, and 3, and so on. This points has this sequence has no accumulation points. While on the circle, if you take any sequence, infinite sequence, it will always have an accumulation point. There's a point where there are very close is the infinite number of points from your sequence. Well, in technical language, the topologist says that the circle is compact and the line is not compact. All right. Well, let me give another very simple example of non-homomorphic spaces. One space consists of line, this is just line, this is x. Another space consists of two lines, this is y. Well, they are not homomorphic. Why? Because on line, if you take any two points, you can connect them by an arc inside your space. Whereas on y, you can take two points which you cannot connect by an arc inside your space. So, in our technical language, we say that this space is connected, and this space is not connected. Well, there are some other tricks like that, some other properties which allow to distinguish spaces. Now I would like to provide more examples of spaces. So at the moment we have a very limited number of examples. So I want to produce more examples. So one method of producing examples is to use operations. Which means that assume you have already have several spaces, you produce new spaces. So assume you have spaces X and Y. These are two spaces. What you can form is a product, X times Y. This is a product, which consists of pairs X, Y, where X, small x, is a point of X. It's a point. X and small y is a point of y. So that's a new space, in many cases, which may be more interesting than the spaces x and y itself. Now let me consider one example. S1 times S1. So you take two circles and you multiply them. So what you get is a so-called two-dimensional torus. So this is called torus. And there is no special symbol for this space. It's just S1 times S1. Now I'm going to draw it. So this is a picture of this torus. Actually, I brought a very small, very tiny toroid with me. So you can see them. You can have different colors if you want. So actually, when I speak about Taurus, I speak only about the surface of this thing. That's the surface of this thing is a Taurus. All right. Now you can consider, for instance, the product of a circle with a two-dimensional disk. This is called a solid torus. In fact, it is just the thing which is, the surface and what is inside. That is, the torus is what you see, but the solid torus is what you eat. So solid torus is the same thing, including the meat inside. So it is everything inside. All right. Now you may observe that the torus is two-dimensional. So if you put yourself here on this surface, you can move in two different dimensions. So that's a two-dimensional space. And you can ask yourself a question. For instance, is it homeomorphic to another two-dimensional space which we know, for instance, to the sphere? That's a very interesting question. Of course, professional mathematicians, they know the answer. But for beginners, I think that's a very good question. Are these two spaces homeomorphic or not? Well, the tricks which we use to do not work. Both spaces are connected. Both are compact. Both are two-dimensional. So how to see whether they are homeomorphic or not? Of course, your guess should be, I think your guess should be no. They are not homeomorphic. But how to prove it? Well, there are two different methods. I would suggest two methods. So the first method comes from the idea of Euler and uses Euler characteristics. So what is Euler characteristic? The Euler characteristic is the following thing. First of all, you triangulate your surface. Now, what does it mean to triangulate the surface? Well, this means to split it into triangles. So you take a certain big number of triangles and you draw them on the surface so that to fill in the surface. Now the conditions of the triangles on the surface is that they should meet in a very nice way, like this. So if I increase this, if I draw more and more triangles, I can triangulate any surface. Well, this fact is very well known in the car industry. Actually, when they project cars, when they construct models, they use triangulations. The surface of a car is approximated by triangles. That turns out to be a convenient way to model it on a computer. So any surface can be triangulated. Well, for instance, a two-dimensional sphere. Let me take a two-dimensional sphere. It's enough to have four triangles. So A, B, C, D. So we have four triangles, ABC, ABD, BCD, and ACD. The union is, of course, the surface of the tetrahedron. And the surface of tetrahedron and two spheres is the same thing from the topological point of view. They are homeomorphic. So this is a triangulation of a two-dimensional sphere. Now you can similarly triangulate any surface. Now, what is the Euler characteristic? The Euler characteristic of any surface, sigma, is defined as follows. Take any triangulation, count the number of vertices, reduce the number of edges and add the number of two-dimensional faces, that is the number of triangles. That is the definition of the Euler factors. Now, the main property of this number, that's an integer number, which to compute it, you need to triangulate your surface. Well, for instance, we can compute it for the two sphere. Here we have four vertices, six edges, and four triangles. So the computation is that the Euler characteristic of a two sphere is equal to two. Now, the main property of this number, that's where topology actually appears, is that it doesn't depend on the choice of triangulation. So that's a theorem which says that the Euler characteristic of a surface does not depend on the choice of triangulation. That's whatever triangulation you use, you will get the same result. For instance, I can triangulate the two sphere using many, many small triangles. But when I make the computation, I will get two. I say just two words about the proof. Very short proof. The idea is that any two triangulations can be related by elementary transformations. So any triangulations of sigma can be related by elementary transformations. In this series, they are usually called moves. By moves. There are only two moves. There are only two moves in dimension 2. Well, in higher dimensions, something similar also is true. But one needs moves. So what are these moves? So assume that your surface is triangulated. Take one triangle of your triangulation, so there are many others. So you take one, you insert one additional vertex, three additional edges, and instead of one triangle, now you have three triangles. Now what happens with the Euler characteristic? You add one new, you have one new vertex, three new edges, so minus three, three new triangles instead of the previous one. So we have two more triangles. So this is zero. Well, the Euler characteristic does not change under this move. So the move consists in inserting one new vertex. So that's the first move. Now the second move is take two triangles which share one edge and replace them with the following picture, remove this edge and insert another edge. Of course, the number of vertices and the edges and so on doesn't change. So that's quite a trivial fact, that any two triangulations of a surface can be related by a finite sequence. Of course, you can use the same move many times, right? You have right to apply it any number of times at different triangles, at different places. It's a non-trivial fact that any triangulations can be related in this way, but it's true that it's convenient to know, useful to know, and the Euler characteristic doesn't change. That's why it is invariant and independent on the choice of triangulation. So that's one possible proof, maybe one of the most difficult proofs. Well, there are much easier proofs. All right. Now we can use this fact to prove that the torus and the two sphere are not homeomorphic. We just compute the Euler characteristics, and we observe that for the two sphere it is 2, and for the torus it is 0. So they are not homeomorphic. All right. All right, you may say, okay, now we solve this question, so what? They are not homeomorphic. There is a second method. I measured only one method, which stems from the Euler characteristic. Now there is another method, which comes from ideas of Poincaré. So the second method, method number two, it stems from the ideas of Poincaré. So Poincaré is a father of topology. He's a French mathematician who worked at the end of the 19th century. One of the genius who formed mathematics. Now, if you ask anybody in France who is a man on the street, who is Poincaré? Well, if he learns history, he would probably tell you that Poincaré was a prime minister at some period. Indeed, Poincaré, the mathematical genius, had a brother who was at some point prime minister of France. That's why his name is remembered. All right. But nevertheless, Poincaré had the following extremely interesting and fruitful idea to associate to any space X a certain group of pylon X, which is called the Poincaré group. Or was a fundamental group? Was a fundamental group of X. Well, how is the group defined? What is the main idea behind the definition? Well, the idea is that you consider loops in this space. A loop is an arc. That's a trajectory of a point which moves in this space and then comes back to the origin. And then, the first thing is that you consider such loops after deformation. If you can deform a loop a little, it is still the same thing. So that you consider loops after deformation. That's the first thing. The second thing, if you have two loops, you can multiply them. Just first follow the first loop, then you follow the second loop. It gives you a product. And what you obtain as a result is a group. That's a group which you can compute in many cases. For instance, the fundamental group of the two-sphere is a trivial group. It consists of only one element. And that's very easy to see. That's an obvious fact. Because if you just look at the sphere, let's look at some loop. Well, for instance, this loop, which parameterizes the equator of the sphere. You position yourself in the northern pole, and you start blowing at this loop. So you can, when you blow from the northern pole, the loop contracts into a point to the south pole. It's true for equator, but it's also true for any other loop, provided it doesn't pass through the north pole. So you take any loop which doesn't pass through the north pole and you blow it to the south pole. Any loop is contractible. They are all equivalent to each other. Now, what about the Taurus? What about the Taurus? What is the fundamental group of the Taurus? Now, the answer is very different. The fundamental group of the Taurus is Z plus Z. So Z is a group of integers. Now you see the groups are different, the first spaces are not formula. Now how you see that the group of the Taurus is Z plus Z? So first you draw the Taurus. Now when you have any loop on the Taurus, for instance, this is a loop on the Taurus. You can count how many times it wins, for instance, in this direction. So let me draw an axis. Let's consider this axis. This is an axis. How many times this loop spins around this axis? You may see this is one in this case. And when it deforms the loop, it's still going to be one. This loop wins around this axis once. Now you can consider the other axis. The other axis is inside the torus. It's a loop inside the torus. And you count how many times your loop wins around this axis. This is going to be twice, two in this case. So the corresponding element, so for this loop is going to be one, two. One here and two. So this loop is not homotopic to the point. All right. Now let me produce more examples of spaces. Actually, up to now, I suggested only one operation which produces spaces. That was multiplication. In fact, it is not a favorite technique used by topologists. Our favorite technique is called cutting and pasting. So topologists cut and paste all the time. Now let me give you an example of this operation. So let me take again a two-dimensional torus. That's a two-dimensional torus. And I cut a small disk out of it. So I cut a small disk out of the torus. And I take two copies of such things. So that's a two torus with a hole. I made a hole. That's another copy of a two torus with a hole. And now I glue them along this circle. So they sort of they are glued along this circle. So what I get another surface which is not a torus. That's something new. I can repeat this procedure. I can cut out another disk and glue something else. For instance, I can obtain a surface with three holes. And so on. In general, I can obtain the surface sigma j with j holes. So this hole number 1, 2 points, and hole number 3. So sigma j is the surface with g holes. Well, now you can ask yourself, okay, we could distinguish, yes, in particular, sigma 0 is just S2, sigma 1 is S1 times S1, and we know that they are not homomorphic. Now, can we solve this homomorphism problem for such surfaces with G-holes? Well, the answer is yes. Now I state the theorem. Thank you. theorem says that sigma j is homeomorphic to sigma j prime. So this equality sign means homeomorphic if and only if g is equal to g prime. So one direction is obvious. If g is equal to g prime, then of course this is just the same thing. What is not obvious is the opposite direction. Now, how to prove it? Now we have good techniques to prove it. Just compute the Euler characteristic. Well, I don't want to give this computation to you, but it's not difficult. So the answer is that the Euler characteristic of sigma j is equal to 2 minus 2j. So if two surfaces are homeomorphic, then they have the same Euler characteristic, therefore the number j's are equal. So that is very easy. Oh, another proof, second method, is based on the fundamental group. You compute their fundamental groups and you compare them, and you observe that they are not isomorphic. These are different groups. So the fundamental groups, if G is not equal to J prime, then the fundamental groups are different. Therefore, the spaces are not homeomorphic. So you see, these are examples of how topologies proceed. First, you construct spaces, so you get them from some other people, like physicists, for instance, or chemists, or criminologists, or whoever. And then you invent some means to show that these spaces have different shapes. All right. Now, so far so good, but now I want to introduce more spaces. Up to now we stayed in dimensions 1 and 2. Now what happens in dimension 3? Are there more interesting objects? So, of course, you may think that if you increase the dimension, you have more and more interesting objects. For instance, in dimension 1, we had only circle and line. In dimension 2, we already have an infinite sequence of interesting surfaces. Now, what happens in dimension 3? Or maybe 4, 5, and so on. Now, the general answer, sort of intuitive answer, is that the difficulty should increase, the number of objects should increase. But the experience shows that the most difficult dimensions, the most interesting, are dimensions 3 and 4. What happens starting from dimension 5 turns out to be a little simpler. And in higher dimensions, 6 and further, it is even more simple. So the most interesting and the most difficult dimensions are 3 and 4. Now I want to define a few new spaces of dimension 3. So they are called length spaces. Now, length spaces, the most geometric way to define length space is to glue them from two pieces. So, the pieces which I want to use are solid toroid. So, I have two. So, this is one solid toroid. I need only two quarters. That's one prism times T2. So, this is the same thing. Well, with the meeting side. So I take two of those, and I'm going to glue them. Unfortunately, I cannot glue them inside the three-dimensional space, inside our space where we live now. So that's the gluing is a little abstract. Now, it is determined by a pair of numbers. I fix a number, P and Q. These are integers. Greater equal than 1. And they should be prime to each other
without common devices.
So starting from such a pair of integers, I'm going to define a certain space which is called denoted LPQ and called the length space of type PQ. So this is a length space of type PQ. So we cannot see this space because it doesn't lie in our three-dimensional space where we are. So, nevertheless, I'm going to define the gluing. So actually what I glue the boundary of this solid torus to the boundary of this solid torus. So the meat inside, and the meat inside here, and the meat inside here, they remain disjoint. I do not identify them. But the boundary here is identified with the boundary here via some method which I want to specify. Now, the idea is the following. Let's consider this curve, this circle. It bounds a disk inside this, the first solid torus. It bounds a disk. I'm going to specify the image of this circle on this solid torus. So the image here, so let it be red. So this this curve is red. It lies on the boundary. Now it is identified with a curve here, which means p times in this direction. So p times in this direction and q times in that direction. So I already explained to you that the fundamental group of the torus of the surface is z plus z. Then the curves up to homotopy are determined by pairs of integers. And I take the curve which corresponds to this pair, pq. It's not easy to draw this curve for big PQ. But there is a curve which meets p times like that and q times like that. There is such a curve. And now I glue the boundary here, this torus, to this torus, so that the red line, the red curve, is identified with the blue curve. If I have time, I will explain how to draw this curve. But right now, just believe me, there is a curve which means p times like that and q times like that. So I take an identification of these two boundaries, which identifies red curve with the blue curve. Well, actually, I have to prove there is such an identification. I need to be more specific. But just believe me, there is such a thing. And after the gluing, I obtain this space. The question is, can we classify this way, this space? Now, why is such a strange space? Why is this strange question, right? In a sense, these are the most simplest, non-trivial three-dimensional spaces. You observe that this space is three-dimensional because the meat here and the meat here are three-dimensional. They have three-dimensional we have 3 degrees of freedom here and here, so the result is three-dimensional. And this is the simplest three-dimensional spaces which one can imagine. Now the question is, what is topological classification? Now our first idea, of course, is to use the tools we already have. What about the Euler characteristics? What about the Euler characteristic? Maybe it distinguishes all them. However, the fact is that the Euler characteristic is always zero for all of them, for any P and Q. So it is of no help. All right. Now let's proceed with the fundamental group. Since Poincaré is a genius, maybe he did the job for us. Almost. Right? So the fundamental group of LPQ turns out to be a cyclic group of order P. So, at least looking at this LPQ, we can recover one number, P. Just compute the fundamental group, take the number of elements. The number of elements of the fundamental group is going to be P. So P is a topological characteristic. If two length spaces are homomorphic, they should have the same P. But what about Q? Now let me state the theorem. Which is due to Rademeister. Which says the following. Length spaces LPQ and LPQ prime are homomorphic. So this equality means they are homomorphic. If and only if either Q minus Q prime is divisible by P, or Q plus Q prime is divisible by P, or the product QQ prime plus 1 is divisible by P, or the product QQ prime minus 1 is divisible by P. So that's a complete classification of this length space. Now, it looks like a lot of conditions, right? But we'll see that in practice it's not so difficult. So that's a complete classification of length spaces. Well, let me give you an example. Let's consider the length spaces L71 and L72. So P is 7, Q is 1, Q prime is 2. Now you see that neither of these conditions is satisfied. Neither of these conditions is satisfied, therefore they are not homomorphic. Now to prove this theorem, Rademeister introduced a new invariant which is completely different from the ideas of Poincaré and Euler. And this is called the Rademeister torsion. So to prove this theorem, he introduced the Rademeister torsion. That's another invariant, different, as you understand, from the Euler characteristic and the fundamental group. In some cases, it is more powerful. In this case, for instance, it is more powerful. And in some other cases, it is less powerful, and you need some other tools. Well, many people worked on this torsion. Rademeister considered only for three-dimensional spaces. Well, then there were other people, France, extended to arbitrary dimensions. Then there were Whitehead, J.H.C. Whitehead, who works on this. Whitehead, who introduced Whitehead torsion. Then Milner worked on that, and many other people. I should just mention that I should just mention that the torsion defined by Rademeister is defined by topological means. That is, for instance, using triangulations. He triangulates this length space or other manifold, other space, and looking at triangulations, he computes certain invariant called Rademeister torsion. Well, if you want roughly speaking, very roughly speaking, the idea is the following. The idea is to associate with a manifold a matrix. So you triangulate your manifold or your space, and then you define the metric as follows. Here you write even dimensional synthesis, even dimensional synthesis, here odd dimensional, and here in each cell you put either 1 or 0 if these two synthesis are incident to each other, you put 1. If they are not incident, you put 0, roughly. What you get is a square matrix, quite a square because you assume that the frequency is 0, then it is square, then it takes an determinant. That's very roughly speaking the idea behind the Rademeister torsion. All right, I think I should stop here. Because one source of ideas is that you consider, say, a three-dimensional sphere, and you consider groups which act on this sphere, or it's a finite groups, or it's a cyclic groups of order 3. And there are very simple actions, just orthogonal actions by orthogonal matrices. And then there's a quotient, and the quotient is going to be a length space. So these are spaces of orbits of some orthogonal actions of finite groups.